Well, Captain Cooper, thank you so much for agreeing to sit down and talk with me about your experiences. And I wonder if we could start, if you wouldn't mind, by talking a bit about how you ended up getting involved in working in the Panama Canal Zone.
Okay, let's see. My grandfather was one of the construction day employees of the canal. And I think he went down there in the about 1904, 1906 from New York State. And and my mother was his daughter, and she grew up in the Canal Zone also. And then my mother went away to college in the United States, University of Alabama. And then went back to Panama after that and worked in the embassy there and met my dad in Panama. And so then I grew up there also. So they worked for the Panama Canal Company. Both of my parents worked for the Panama Canal Company. And I grew up there, and I sort of followed along in their footsteps working for the company.
Oh, wow. Did they pass down any stories about their early experiences in Panama? Are they?
Yeah, my mother was, both of them actually. My mother was a little more vocal on that. She had quite a bit of experience there, and the tales would come out here and there. And when she got there, evidently, there were roads, but it was all mud. It was dirt roads, and I always thought that it was rather interesting the way that her trip with her mother happened, how they got from New York State down to Panama. And I think the order of events was that the men were hired and were recruited and hired in the United States. For instance, my grandfather in New York State was what you'd call a jack of all trades, master of none. He was a plumber, he was a welder, this and that. So they hired these sorts of men, craftsmen, to come down and work. And they took the men down on ships from New York, and after they got the men settled, the families were brought down. So I always imagined a woman and her two small children. I think my mother was 2 years old. Her brother was older a little bit. So anyway, a woman who'd never been outside the United States goes down to New York City from Saratoga, New York, and gets on a ship with two small children to sail over the ocean to go somewhere strange. Wow. To me, that's pretty unique. And, of course, the ships weren't like cruise liners are today. There was no air conditioning, a lot of people on board. And then they arrive in this place that's got a lot of mosquitoes, and it rains a lot, and it's hotter than blue blazes. And they got to make a home there. And they can't just turn around and take an airplane out of there. Mm-hmm. So I always thought that was rather unique.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So they when you were growing up, I'm assuming you went to school in Panama,
right? In the Canal Zone.
In the Canal Zone.
Yeah, we referred to the Canal Zone that way because that was actually the official title of the area where we lived. The Canal Zone was leased from Panama in a special agreement when they decided to build a canal. So the Canal Zone, that area, was where we lived. We lived within that area. Okay. And we went back and forth freely into Panama, and there were no fences, no borders really, but we refer to the Canal Zone as that because that's where we spent most of our time.
Okay.
And what did you say first there a minute ago? You asked me.
Oh, I was going to ask you, I think.
Oh, yeah, I went to school there.
Yeah, what school was like and which school you went to.
I lived in a very small town in the Canal Zone called Gamboa. And it was at the junction of the main river that supplies water to the canal, which is the Chagres River. Mm-hmm. The town was at the junction of the river and the canal itself. And the town was what you would call a company town, or maybe even a division town, because the dredging division of the canal company was headquartered there. Mm-hmm. They had dredges, they had cranes, they had tugboats. So they did a lot of dredging, and all these people were involved in that particular part of the canal operation, who lived in this town. And we had our a few policemen stationed there. We had a little fire station, you know, and the other services that the canal company provided. So this small town was actually physically located almost at the center of the Isthmus of Panama, in the middle. And we went to school and elementary school there in Gamboa up to the sixth grade. And then after that, we had to take a bus into what we called town, which was Balboa on the Pacific side of the Isthmus.
Okay.
It was just closer there than it was to the Atlantic side of the Isthmus. So yeah, I went to elementary school there. I went to my first 2 years of high school in Balboa, at the Balboa High School. And then because I already had a goal or a career in mind, my parents let it be known that I wasn't making the grade. I was not a good student. I wasn't making good enough grades to be able to pursue my goal. So they asked me if I wanted to go away to school in the States, to a boys' military school, and I did. And it was probably one of the most difficult things I did, but it was the best for me. I went away to school, and I went on to train for my occupation, and then I came back to Panama to work for the company.
Okay.
That's how it went.
Uh-huh. And so did you, when you went to school, which school did you go to in the States?
I finished my last 2 years of high school at a boys' military school called Admiral Farragut Academy in St. Petersburg, Florida.
Oh, okay.
And my parents researched all that before they even broached the subject of leaving home. And so I went 2 years there, and then I went on to a maritime academy for my maritime training.
Had you growing up, was that the kind of career that you wanted, a maritime career?
Right, yes.
Okay.
My dad was a dredger. He worked on the dredges that were out in the waterway, and my mother worked in the office of the dredging division. And I went out on the dredge with my dad. I started doing that when I was probably 8 years old. So hanging around the dredge and meeting all those men that worked there and seeing the operation and being on the water became a big attraction to me. And there were tugboats that would come to the dredge to bring the scows or barges to the dredge. And finally, these tugboat captains took pity on me and invited me up to their tugs. They saw that my interest was there. And they invited me up on the tug. And then the next thing you know, I'm riding the tugs up and down the waterway with the barges. And that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a tugboat captain. And my dad says, no, no. He says, there's pilots on this on these ships that are going by here. You want to be a pilot. So that became my new goal.
Okay.
But growing up on the water was what, and going to work with my dad was what got me interested and started in the career. That was a huge help. At least I had a goal.
Yeah.
If you're not a good student, sometimes you don't have a goal. You know, you got to get a goal.
Yeah, yeah.
If I can add that.
Exactly. Well, and what was Maritime Academy like? You already had some background, or?
Yeah, I fit in very well because I grew up on the water. I was already much of a seaman. I was. I knew about seamanship. I knew about boats and other marine operations and things. And when I went to the Maritime Academy, I started in New York State at the New York State Maritime Academy, Fort Schuyler, New York. And so I already had all that experience as a teenager, and it made it a lot easier for me. And the fact that I went to that boys' military school, which was really an ordeal for me, the fact that I had been there now for 2 years, I was used to the regimented military system that the Maritime Academy had. It was you wore uniforms, you lived under a regimented system, much like the military. So I was ready for that. It worked out for me.
All right. And what were the did I ask you which maritime school that you went to?
I told you, but I'll add a little to that.
Okay.
I I went from St. Petersburg, Florida, that boys' military high school,
okay,
up to Fort Schuyler in New York.
Fort Schuyler.
Actually, it's right next to New York City. It's part of New York City.
Okay.
It's in the Bronx, and it's called the New York State Maritime Academy. Okay. I went there, started there, and as I said earlier, I was not a student, not a good student. And I realized there that I excelled in nautical subjects, but I did not do well in subjects non-nautical. Mm-hmm. My interest was not there. I didn't care about economics. I was interested in English because I liked to speak well and to write well, and but I was not interested in courses that I didn't think or would not need or knew I would not need in the maritime industry. Mm-hmm. That goal to me was so clear that I knew what I needed to have to succeed. And I came up against calculus at the Maritime Academy. And I knew that I didn't need calculus to be a ship's officer or a pilot. Even if I hadn't known that, I couldn't have passed calculus to save my life. It was Greek to me. Mm-hmm. And I failed the calculus course. I took it again, failed it again, and I knew it was hopeless. So after I failed it the second time, they said, you have got to take calculus during the summer, this summer coming up, and you got to pass it, or else. Or else meaning you're out, because they had a set curriculum. Mm-hmm. So I called the Texas Maritime Academy in Galveston, Texas. They were brand new. Whereas Fort Schuyler came into existence in the 1800s. Mm-hmm. And I asked the Texas Maritime Academy if they required calculus, and they didn't. And I transferred down there.
Okay.
I hitchhiked from New York City to Galveston, Texas, wearing my military uniform that we had from, that we used at Fort Schuyler. Because I didn't want to ask my parents for any money. And I was ashamed of the fact that I flunked out. But they didn't require calculus, and they needed guys who could help that school get started. They needed people who were truly interested in the maritime industry and had some experience, which I did. It went well. Worked out well for me.
Uh-huh. What year did you finish the academy?
I finished down there in the same amount of time, or at the same time that I would have finished in New York in 1967.
Okay.
And at that time, the Vietnam War was raging, and the Merchant Marine itself did not have enough officers because so many ships were in use carrying military cargo to South Vietnam. So I went right from the Maritime Academy in Texas aboard a freighter going to Vietnam.
Wow.
No problem. I mean, that's what I wanted to do.
What was your position to start
with? I started out as a third mate.
Okay.
That's the third officer on the ship. Mm-hmm. Every ship has a captain. They have a first mate, a second mate, and a third mate.
And did you, was that a regular service back and forth between the States and South Vietnam?
Almost. It was almost regular, meaning the company I worked for was a very big, well-established company from New Orleans. Mm-hmm. That was Likes Brothers Steamship Company. They had 70-some ships, and that's a lot of ships for a shipping company. And at the time, they really needed people. But they still had trade routes all around the world other than South Vietnam. The South Vietnam cargo was carried under military contracts, but they had other commercial runs throughout the world. Mm-hmm. And so I bounced around on different ships wherever they assigned me and ran to those different areas, the Mediterranean, Northern Europe, the Caribbean, a lot to the Far East, meaning Trans-Pacific. Mm-hmm. the whole part of the goal at that point was I had to move up through the ranks to second mate, to chief mate and to captain, because Panama required that you have a master's license, a captain's license, mm-hmm. before they would hire you as a pilot. Mm-hmm. And I knew that. I knew what the requirements were.
Okay.
So that's what I'm working for, what I was working for then. And they didn't force you to take vacation, and I liked living on the ships. So for about 5 years, I sailed as an officer.
Okay.
All over the place, making pretty good money and having a lot of fun and satisfying the requirements for the goal.
How do you move up the ranks as an officer?
The company has, of course, usually would maintain a seniority list of all of its officer employees. And when they needed a second mate, and they might have a third mate somewhere that they wanted to promote. But to become a second mate, you had to have at least 1 year of sea time or service as a third mate.
Okay.
So after a year as third mate, you take another test with the Coast Guard, another examination, and you get a second mate's license. And that license allows you to sail as second mate. And you go year by year moving up.
Okay.
If the company has jobs for you.
Oh, okay. So.
But with the Vietnam War, there are plenty of jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So anyone who is energetic and ambitious could move up during the Vietnam War. And the same thing is happening now. There's a lot of ships today involved in carrying cargo over to the Middle East, and a lot of young guys who are young, strong, and ambitious are doing very well because they're in that effort, sailing as officers on ships.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it took place. And I sailed and advanced my license until I got a master's license, and then I applied to the Panama Canal Company, and I got hired.
Wow. What, and what year was that? About?
That was 1972.
1972. Okay. Yeah. Did you, during those years, as when you started at the academy in 1972, when you started working in the Panama Canal Zone, you know, and then earlier, I talked to Captain Wilder about his experiences a bit earlier.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of the major technological changes that were occurring in maritime that had an impact on you or that you saw?
Technological. Let's see. I had sailed as an officer on older ships.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they put most of their new people. If you were young and just starting out, they weren't going to put you on a nice fancy ship. They wanted to see how you were as an officer, and they put you on an old piece of junk, which was fine with me because old pieces of junk or old rusty freighters stayed in port longer. They were slower to transit the different areas. It took 28 days to go from Balboa, Panama, to Yokohama, Japan, or Incheon, Korea, across the Pacific. 28 days poking along at 14 knots with no air conditioning. But when you're young, you don't care about too much about air conditioning. And if you're having a good time and you're enjoying going to sea, it doesn't really matter. So the old ships were just fine with me. I didn't need a new ship. Mm-hmm. Actually, my very first trip to sea as a third mate on the William Likes, it was a C2 freighter, that's what they called it, the C2. I had a very, very nice captain, and the captain was 40-some years old. First mate was 60-some years old. The second mate was 60-some years old. And the third mate, I was 22 years old. In the South China Sea, on a beautiful afternoon, one of our crew members jumped over the side to commit suicide.
Mm.
So the captain wanted to launch a lifeboat to try to go and get this guy, rescue him.
Mm-hmm.
And the first mate, the second mate, being that old, were not going to get in the lifeboat. I mean, it was unreasonable to ask them to get in the lifeboat and take it down and try to rescue the man. The captain's certainly not going to leave the ship, so that left me. So I get in this lifeboat, and this was in August of 1967. And during that time of year, the southwest monsoons blow. That's a wind. And they blow continuously, and the wind kicks up big swells and big sea. So we launched this lifeboat, and as soon as we hit the water with a lifeboat, we were in rough seas, big seas, probably a 12-foot swell, maybe a 15-foot swell. And a swell is a long, big wave that's not usually breaking. Mm-hmm. But we had about 6 or 8 foot seas that were breaking. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty rough, and these lifeboats were old, they were very strong. And I had about, in a lifeboat back then there would be maybe 8 or 9 men. And when we got into the water, when the lifeboat was launched, we could see right away this was extremely dangerous. We also realized that we're not going to find this man. His name was Floyd W. Heiss. I've never forgotten that. Hmm. And your perspective from high up on a ship, looking down on the ocean, is much different from your perspective when you're down right on the water in a small boat. The lifeboat's maybe 30 feet long. Mm-hmm. It's got an engine. It's got a lot of oars if you need to row it. So we weren't going to find Floyd W. Heiss, and it was apparent right away. Mm-hmm. We were in a very bad situation. And we decided to conduct a search pattern for him with this lifeboat. As we started out to do so, we left the ship, moved away, and remember, we're out in the middle of the South China Sea. There's nothing around. And the engine on the lifeboat quits. Mm. And it got real quiet out there. Actually, it was beautiful. The waves were breaking. The beautiful day. The ocean was blue. And the ship's 2 miles away, and the engine quits. And as it turned out, the ship came back to get us and got us. It came right alongside. And even in that high seas and heavy swell, we were able to reattach the lifeboat to the ship, which took a lot of luck and a good amount of skill. Mm-hmm. We were extremely lucky. And the ship picked us up again. In other words, hoisted that lifeboat right up the side, mm-hmm. rolling and pitching all the time. When we got back aboard the ship, the first thing the captain said to me was, "When I saw you hit the water with that boat, I knew I should have never sent you." We lucked out.
Yeah.
We didn't find Floyd W. Heiss, but we got the boat back with all the people. Mm-hmm. That was my real introduction to true seagoing life. You know? So it was a good experience for me, and it was very, very lucky that I was already a boatman. Mm-hmm. A lot of young guys go to sea right out of the Maritime Academy, and they don't really have the experience to handle a situation like that. I already knew how to handle that boat. Mm-hmm. It worked out for me, again.
Okay. Wow. So after that, you know, did you have any other memorable experiences before you came to Panama?
I went up through the ranks to second mate, and I stayed on a particular old ship for about a year, the Tilly Likes. And here again, no air conditioning, and it was a big deal when you had a corner room and 2 portholes. So I was living very well. We ran to the Mediterranean, we ran to North Europe, and of course we ran to the Far East through the Panama Canal. And I truly enjoyed going to sea, going to all these different places. Mm-hmm. And these older ships, like I said before, they stayed in port longer because they didn't have the modern cargo gear that allowed them to load or discharge quickly. Mm-hmm. And so life was good when I was 22, 24 years old, traveling the world, you know.
Uh-huh.
And then I got hired in Panama, and I went back there.
In 72?
In 72, 1972, okay. Yeah.
And did you start right away as a pilot, or did you have to work up?
No, what they did at the time was they would hire you, and then you would go into a training program. Where you rode with other pilots through the canal. Mm-hmm. And you observed them. You also visited other parts of the company, the locks, the tugboats that worked there, and you got to know the operation through observation and And that took, maybe 6 months or so. And the more you rode with other pilots on ships going through the canal, the more you learned, the more comfortable you got, and the more comfortable these other pilots got with you. And so pretty soon the other pilots start letting you handle the ship under their supervision. So it's a slow process, but it's still quite rewarding. So it took a while to get started on my own, I think 6 months or so, and then you start out on small ships, piloting them through the canal. And you work your way up over the years. There's a 10-year period for your advancement from the very beginning to the largest ship that goes through there. And you need all those 10 years to gain experience and confidence. So I enjoyed my career.
Captain Cooper, what were some of the challenges, let's say when you were first starting on the smaller ships, could you describe the process of piloting a ship through the locks?
Yeah, let's see now. You usually pick the ship up at one of the ends of the canal, in the ocean, let's say, or at sea, or at one of the anchorages at either end of the canal, either the Pacific end or the Atlantic end, which is really the Caribbean end of the canal. And you go aboard and you introduce yourself and you make sure everything's ready and you get the ship underway. In other words, you get it moving. And you are giving orders to the helmsman who is steering the ship, and you're giving orders to the officer that's handling the engine room telegraph. The engine room telegraph transmits orders to the engine room on what you want done with the engines. Do you want to go slow ahead or half ahead or full ahead? How much power do you want and what direction do you want it? Do you want to go astern? It's like a car stepping on the accelerator, except you're doing it verbally. And you're giving orders and you're using your judgment, your eye, to maneuver the ship. Just like you when you're driving your car, you're steering the car and you're using your eyes and using your senses and your judgment to control the car. On the ship, we're standing up, usually looking out, looking ahead through the bridge windows, and you're using your senses, like I said, and telling them where to put the rudder to steer the ship and what to do with the engines. And you go in the locks, you slow down, you maneuver the ship into the locks, and go from there. I didn't have much trouble, because here again I was very comfortable in the canal. I'd grown up there. So I was totally at home in the area. If you tried to do that in a strange area that you were not familiar with, you would have to work a lot harder to learn the area and feel comfortable. A lot of young men go to different ports in the world and become pilots, and they have to work very hard to learn the different peculiarities of the waterway and all the other things that they need to pick up to be able to safely pilot there.
All right. Earlier, Captain Wilder had mentioned that your knowledge as a pilot was very, I think the term he used was local.
That's correct.
Knowledge or local.
Yeah, that's
each port is distinct.
That's correct. Each port, each waterway is quite distinct, and that's why they employ pilots in all these different ports and waterways around the world, because the pilot has local knowledge. That's the term. He knows about that area. That's his specialty. When you're a ship's officer and you're traveling the world, you're trained to maneuver that ship far out at sea. And when you get close to shore or coming into a port, as you slow down and come near the port's entrance or the river's entrance, you pick up a pilot. And he then guides the ship in with your help. We're there to take the orders from the pilot. He guides you in. But when you're traveling the world and going to all these places as a ship's officer, you can't be expected to know all these areas well enough to be able to safely go in and out of port or up and down these rivers or through the canal. So.
And then now, one of the things that Captain Wilder mentioned was with locomotives. and having to give orders to locomotives mm-hmm. as the, can you describe that process? I want to make sure I have that down.
Yeah. Correctly. Yeah. Well, did he mention the word mule?
I don't think he used that term.
He used the term locomotive, huh?
He did. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
Well, the locks are built out of concrete and they have chambers, and the ship goes into the chamber. Now, there may be a lot of room on either side of the ship in the chamber, depending on the size of the ship, or there might not be a lot of room. There might be only 2 feet on each side. And to keep the ship from touching the concrete walls of the chamber and having damage to the ship or the locks, they have electric locomotives that run down on tracks on either side of the chamber. Now, from these locomotives that are on the tracks on either side are wires that go to the ship, cables. Mm-hmm. And the cables attach to either side of the ship, at either end of the ship. And then the men that are driving these locomotives or operating them keep the ship in the center by pulling on one cable and slacking on another. So they're maintaining that ship's position in the center of the chamber. Mm-hmm. To keep it from touching the wall. And what these men do with the winches on these locomotives, and how they do that is from orders given to them by radio by the pilot, from the pilot. Okay. The pilot is telling the operators of the locomotives what to do, because the pilot has the vantage point of being up high mm-hmm. and seeing the whole picture around the ship. Whereas these locomotive operators are just down on the locomotive, and they can't really judge well enough from that their position.
Yeah.
So, small ships would have four locomotives, a locomotive on each side of the bow or the front of the ship, and a locomotive on each side of the stern or the rear of the ship. Mm-hmm. And so you're keeping it in the center by giving orders to the different locomotives.
And how do you give the orders? Let's say that you're piloting a ship and you see it's drifting a bit to the right. I mean, what is your...
Okay. Each locomotive is numbered and also described by his position relative to the ship. The forward locomotives are number one. Each one is number one locomotive, but there's one on the center wall side, and there's one on the sidewall side. Mm-hmm. So it would be one center and one side, designated that way. The second pair of locomotives back on the stern of the ship are number twos. So you would designate, if you wanted the number one center to pull, then you would say one center coil in. But you have to slack off on the other one, on the opposite side, so he can pull over. Mm-hmm. So you'd say one center coil, one side slack. You're just giving quick orders like that over a radio, mm-hmm. and they respond. In the early days before radios came along, they did it. The pilots gave orders through hand signals, different signals, and at night they used flashlights or wands, mm-hmm. colored wands to give the orders with their hands. So anyway, actually, when you asked a question earlier about keeping or any difficulties I had in the early years, when you're giving orders like that, you have to maintain in your mind a record of exactly what orders you have given. And you have to remember what each one of those locomotives is doing. And that takes some mental dexterity to juggle all that information in your mind. So if I'm coiling on one center and slacking on one side, I've got to remember that I don't want him to coil it all the way over to the concrete. Right. So I have to stop coiling one center, one side hold. And then you're doing the same with the stern locomotives. So there's quite a bit of mental effort in juggling these orders and things. Mm-hmm. And that took me a while. But with practice and time, it comes to you.
What about the speed? I mean, is the ship, I'm assuming, is going pretty slowly.
Yeah.
Is there ever a situation where the ship gets in front of the locomotives and pulls them?
Did Captain Wilder tell you to ask me that?
No, he didn't, but he mentioned something about it and he in passing, and he,
yeah.
I want to make sure I have this down.
Yeah. It's, well, yes, the ship can overrun the locomotives. Mm-hmm. The locomotives, the present ones anyway, run along the track at a speed, a maximum speed of 3 knots. So they're effective up to that speed. After that, the ship starts to overtake them and pass them. And then they, then the locomotive will drop out of position and be less effective on the ship. Mm-hmm. Now, Captain Wilder is one of my favorite pilots. And he was one of a number of fast pilots in the canal. And I guess I admired that, and my experience before I got there allowed me to turn into a fast pilot. So it was one of the things that we had to guard against, overrunning the locomotives, getting up too much speed. I can say it now, but I wouldn't have said it years ago. That sort of added to the challenge and the excitement of the transit. Now, that should not have entered into what we were doing. We were charged with the safety of that ship, and we had no business cowboying through the canal. On the other hand, the canal company wanted pilots to move ships, and we had a schedule, and we had a lot of ships to put through every day, maybe 40-some ships. And the canal company did not want pilots to lose time. And if we gained time, okay, if we could do it safely.
Yeah.
And that's that took place. There were other pilots who were more cautious, more sensible, who took their time and made sure that it was going to be done safely. I wouldn't have said this 10 years ago.
Okay.
But that's actually what was happening. And we had a still had a very good safety record.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you can be a fast pilot if you're careful and skillful. And one of the things that a pilot definitely has to know is how to get out of trouble. And I'm an instructor now at a maritime institute, and I teach other pilots and ships officers how to maneuver ships. And coincidentally, the reason I can teach them well is because I have a lot of experience on the canal and working faster than normal. And the many jams and situations that I got into, which I myself created, gave me a tremendous amount of experience in getting out of trouble. That's actually what's going on now. I'm passing on my experience to young men and women who are learning ship handling. And I can tell them it's not worth it. It's not worth it to go too fast.
What were some of the jams that you got into? Captain Wilder described one of his.
Did he really?
Oh, yes. Yes.
I've got to go find him here now and tell him what I said. Generally, it's... the speed is more of a problem as you're approaching the locks. And you have to know how to get that speed off the ship, get the ship slowed down, and under better control. If you lose control entirely, you've got to know how to get it back. And it's got to be done quickly. Now, let's see, I'm trying to think now. actually, one of the examples I use with my classes is that I was coming up to the Gatun locks northbound through the canal one morning about 6 o'clock in the morning. And I had been up most of the night. And I'd gone to work maybe about 11 o'clock at night without much prior sleep. And at 6 o'clock in the morning, it was starting to get light. And I'm going to put that ship to anchor. I'm not going to actually go to the locks and go in the locks. I'm going to go to anchor in a big, wide open space in the Gatun Lake. No other ships were in the anchorage. It was wide open for me. I had lots and lots of room to go to anchor. I slowed the ship down properly, as I should have. Now she's going slower, and we're 2 miles from the anchorage. And I'm so sleepy that I want to get that ship anchored. I want to get where I want to go, get anchored, because the ship has a pilot cabin, and I can go to bed. Because I'm going to have to wait for 4 hours for the locks. Do you follow me?
Yes, sir.
So I increase speed again because I'm so sleepy and so tired, I want to get there. I want to go to bed. That is a classic example of how fatigue can enter into a person's decision-making process. Fatigue and my desire to go to sleep, and the thought of that bunk waiting for me back there, the fact there were no other ships in the anchorage, contributed to my bad decision of increasing speed again. Well, I increased the speed, then I realize I'm going too fast. I slowed down earlier for a purpose, but now I increased the speed, and I'm going way too fast. I cannot get the ship stopped in time. She sails up and hits the locks hard. Well, they didn't, the maritime industry was not really aware or interested in fatigue at that time. This is when, 1985 maybe? They didn't factor in fatigue to accidents at that time. Now they do. There are rules for the amount of sleep that people operating machinery or making decisions like that have to have. Rest periods. So nothing was said about fatigue, and I didn't even know about fatigue at the time. I knew why I did that.
Yeah.
And so anyway, we had to, that was about $500,000 worth of damage to the ship, and, you know, we had to fix it. My mistake. But it's good experience. I'm able to pass that on now.
Yeah.
Don't do it.
Yeah, you can only learn something when you make mistakes.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But you basically, because I don't really understand anything at all about maritime, the ship had reached a certain speed where it didn't even matter. I mean, if you had said, you know, full, you know, reverse engines or whatever, it just didn't matter. It was just going to, the momentum
that's
was
correct.
Carried into the...
That's correct.
Wow.
That's correct. The ship was the Hyundai number 78. It was loaded with steel products. And that heavy load in that ship gave it tremendous momentum and inertia.
Okay.
Tremendous. And yes, I could start the engines going astern, in other words, in reverse, like you say, but the power of the ship wasn't enough to take away the excessive headway that I'd built up. And there was nothing else that I could do at the time. So that was my situation.
Captain Cooper, what were some of the other things that made the canal system a unique situation for pilots?
One of the most unique the most unique factor in piloting in Panama was the fact that the Panama Canal Company owned the place, to put it that way. They owned the water, they owned the land on each side of the waterway. They owned the waterway and all the equipment, and it was their operation solely, only their operation. There was no outside oversight from, let's say, the Coast Guard or Panama or anyone else. So they ran the show. Now, in today's world, when pilots have accidents, there's an awful lot of oversight in place. The pilot is watched over by the Coast Guard in U.S. ports, or the Japanese Coast Guard in Japanese ports. They're watched over by environmental groups. They're watched over by bird lovers, because we don't want to spill oil, it kills birds. So there is a tremendous amount of threat to the pilot And with that threat goes a lot of second guessing by these groups. The pilot's using his skill and judgment to the best of his ability to control the ship and to keep it safe. But accidents happen. And in many cases, there are numerous factors that lead up to an accident. And all of these factors have to be looked at before you can make a judgment about the accident. The media can't look at those factors. They don't know what they are. Neither can the bird lovers. And to tell you the truth, neither can the U.S. Coast Guard, because they don't have experience in ship handling. That's a fact. There's, in an accident, whether it be a rail accident or an airline accident or a marine accident, and probably a car accident too, there's something called the error chain. There's a chain, there's usually a chain of errors that occurs starting before the time of the actual incident or accident. And so I've learned that now after many years, and after my training to be an instructor, I've learned that. And I pass that on. And you have to watch for the error chain when you're working. If you recognize that there's an error chain building, you have to break the error chain to prevent the accident. But this knowledge and this theory was not present back in the early years. We didn't know anything about that. Did I get off on a tangent?
No, no, not at all. I mean, because it really, it gets to the challenge that you must have had, because you had a company, you had a responsibility to get so many ships through. There's a schedule at the same time.
Right.
Fatigue and different things right. can enter in.
That's right. And that's what was taking place. They had to move ships to prevent backlogs from developing. They had to move ships in a timely manner to get them through the canal, because the shipper or the ship owner is really a customer of the canal. And we had to provide this service to these customers. Mm-hmm. And you can't have 10,000 stems of bananas sitting out in the anchorage waiting for days and days because traffic is slow.
Right.
You can't do it. Mm-hmm. So, yes, the company wanted to move ships. If you didn't move ships well, they might overlook it for the most part, but they'd want to know why. Mm-hmm. Why were you so late at the locks? Well, blah, 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 huh? And that was the climate.
What were some of the factors? I mean, speaking of the climate, I mean, I'm assuming that climate factored into this, but what were some of the factors that could possibly slow down the movement of ships?
Poor visibility.
Okay.
By rain or fog. We would have heavy rainstorms, and we would have fog during the night in certain areas and mm-hmm. at different times of the year. So you had to guard against that. And a rainstorm, a lot of times you can see it coming, but in the fog, we had a pretty good idea when it was going to come in. So we were able to avoid most of that sort of problem.
Mm-hmm. Were there any times of the year that were peak shipping seasons, more busier than others? Or is it more steady?
They may have statistics on that. I don't know. It seems steady to me. Mm-hmm. I'd look out in that anchorage where the ships were waiting. The ships come in from sea and they anchor in a certain area, and it's called the anchorage. Mm-hmm. That's where they wait. Mm-hmm. And I would look out of that anchorage and there would always be ships there. And as I got older as a pilot, you know, we were working very hard and I was getting a little tired out. Mm-hmm. And I remember saying one day, you know something, these ships never stop coming. They're always there. Huh? It never ends, right?
Right.
And that's what's happening today, too. They're still there.
Yeah. Did you want to talk a little bit about life outside of work, social life? I mean, maybe the differences between, you know, your experience growing up versus your children. Was there any changes occurring?
Yeah, I guess there were, up until the 90s, there was not a lot of major change that you noticed very much.
Yeah.
After the treaty started taking effect, we did start to notice the changes. And the changes were not good, in, not in my opinion. Mm-hmm. The quality of life went downhill. The quality of the workplace that I was used to also went downhill. Mm-hmm. I was not happy. My last 4 or 5 years there were not nearly as satisfying as my early years. I retired as soon as I could.
And what year did you retire?
I retired in 97.
I saw, okay.
1997. After 25 years, and it was time for me to go. I was experiencing a classic burnout, mm-hmm. where I was dissatisfied with the changes in the workplace and the climate there, the living conditions, and no amount of time or money was going to correct that. That's classic burnout. To me, it is. Mm-hmm. And it was good that I moved on at age 52, because I went back into the marine industry, and I did other jobs that were very interesting and provided me with a whole different set of challenges. I was quite happy after I retired. I was very lucky that I was. A lot of people retire and they're not happy, because yeah. they miss the occupation.
Mm-hmm. And Captain Cooper, were you a part of the Pilots Association?
Yes, yeah. Most of us were, yeah.
Okay, and what did the Pilots Association, I mean, what were some of its functions? I mean, what did it do?
It, number one, it organized the pilots as a group. Mm-hmm. And it's a form of unionism, mm-hmm. which I'm pro-union. Mm-hmm. Because the marine industry and many other industries has a long history of, I don't know if I want to go as far as employee abuse, but that's what it borderlines on. Mm-hmm. And to protect the employee, unions or employee organizations can be very beneficial, mm-hmm. to make sure that the company treats the workers fairly. And yes, I was part of the Pilots Association. It was, and the association was very good, and it was what I consider to be fair in their dealings with the canal company. And I'm very glad that I was a union member.
Did the association have collective bargaining with the canal company?
Yes.
Or did it, okay.
Yes. And that, I think at the time when it came into effect, I think that was unusual. I'm not so sure that too many government employees enjoyed that privilege. Mm-hmm. We were U.S. government employees. Mm-hmm. We worked for the U.S. government, who owned that canal and operated it. And for us to achieve collective bargaining rights was a significant step, very significant. Mm-hmm. And I was a proponent of moderation to keep from being unreasonable with our dealings with the canal company. Mm-hmm. So it worked out well.
By moderation, you mean in terms of what you as an association requested or
demanded.
Demanded, uh-huh.
Right. I thought we should focus on safety, time off, mm-hmm. and money. Let's be safe. Let's be compensated for the many hours we put out there, mm-hmm. and let's have proper rest period, mm-hmm. which ties into that fatigue example I gave you.
Right.
So you could have all the rest possible, or excuse me, you could be given all the time off possible, but if you don't use that time properly to rest properly, it doesn't do you any good.
Right.
But sometimes it's hard to get to sleep at 8 o'clock at night when you're going to go to work at 11 o'clock at night. Because that is not in keeping with the body's normal circadian No. rhythm. It just doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. So by 6 o'clock in the morning, your ability to think clearly is definitely hindered if you don't. So, but many companies that don't allow collective bargaining or don't care about their employees could just dictate that, well, you're going to work. If you don't like it, get out. I hope I didn't go off on too much of a tangent there.
No, it makes perfect sense because it gets back to what you were talking about earlier about, you know, the safety, about all of the things that people on the outside don't think about if they hear about an accident.
Or, yeah.
They just assume, oh, and there's a term, it's called pilot error, and you always think, well, what does that mean?
Is it? It's human error.
It's Yeah. But there can be a lot of things, and you hear about it in the airlines too. I mean, in a collective bargaining, certainly airline pilots make that one of their main issues.
Right.
You know, a certain, you're only allowed to do a certain number of trips, and after
that,
you have to take,
So it's, overall, it was a very good career for me. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I found it very, very satisfying. I enjoyed it, like, completely. Mm-hmm. And this simulator that I teach on right now, I just came back yesterday from Baltimore. That simulator is so realistic that it actually satisfies about 60% of my yearning to continue ship handling.
Wow.
It's very realistic, and it serves me well also, besides the students that we have.
Uh-huh.
If you enjoy your occupation or your work, then when you retire and don't do that anymore, you'll miss it.
Right. Most definitely. Do you make it down to Panama much anymore, Captain Cooper? Do you?
I only go maybe every 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't been lately.
Okay. Do you usually attend the reunions?
These reunions here, yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. When I'm not working.
Uh-huh.
Even though I'm retired, I work part time in different places, and if I'm off, I'll come up here. It's an easy drive for me.
Okay. All right. Well, I know I've taken up a lot of your time.
No problem.
Are there any other stories or experiences you'd like to relate? Or
I thought you might ask about the most unique ship I ever took through the canal, or vessel.
Okay.
Most unique vessel.
Okay.
And so I thought about it. I've been thinking about it for the past week. By far, the most unique vessel that I ever took through the canal was one of the Navy's nuclear-powered ballistic missile submarines. Did Captain Wilder mention those?
No, he didn't. But, you know, the town I grew up in Bremerton, Washington, we were Poseidon, Trident class.
Right.
Big subs.
Yeah. Yeah, so these submarines were extremely unique and very, very special. They trained, I guess, 30 out of 180 pilots or so to take these subs through the canal. And I noticed early on that after I would pilot one of those submarines through the canal, I would go home, and that experience would stay with me for 2 or 3 days. It would just be on my mind. It would be there, and I'd be recalling little things about the transit, and whereas on a normal ship that you take through the canal, an hour after you're off the ship, you've forgotten about it. And you might not even remember the name of the ship an hour later. But a nuke sub, or that's what they used to call them, nuclear subs, was so unique and so impressive that that experience would stay with you for days.
What was the difference between piloting a nuclear submarine versus a ship?
Well, the nuclear submarine has probably 3 or 4 factors connected with it that make it different from regular ships. Number one, the design of the submarine is totally different from a regular ship. Mm-hmm. A regular ship has a pointed bow, usually has a flat bottom and a rounded stern, and they all maneuver almost the same. The basics for maneuvering regular ships are about the same for almost every ship. But because of the difference or the unique design of the submarine, that vessel does not maneuver like a ship. It doesn't maneuver like anything else in the world. And it has its own peculiarities, and you have to learn those peculiarities to be able to maneuver it.
Mm-hmm.
It has that teardrop shape.
Mm-hmm.
It has the big rounded bow.
Right.
And most of the submarine is underwater. There's only a tiny portion on the surface that's visible. And they're about 560 feet long, and I think they're 40-some feet wide. And they're drawing, they're down in the water something like 38 feet. Mm-hmm. And that design alone makes it a major challenge to maneuver. There's a couple of other things about the sub that make it difficult to maneuver. The propeller on a submarine is aft or behind the rudder. And therefore, when the propeller is turning ahead, producing thrust to move the sub through the water, because the rudder's ahead of that propeller, there's no wash from the propeller to give you rudder action. You depend on the movement of the sub through the water alone to create a water flow past the rudder. And to get that water flow past the rudder, you have to gain headway and thereby momentum and inertia. So on a regular ship, you can just touch the engine and the wash, the propeller turns, the wash hits the rudder, and you can turn easily. Mm-hmm. A submarine doesn't turn easily.
Never thought of that.
Yeah, it's quite unique. Then the submarine also has a lot of appendages to it that you can't see. They're underwater, the fins and different things like that. And you can't get close to the lock walls for that reason. You don't want to knock off a fin or something. In fact, those submarines are so special, you don't want to touch anything, nothing. You don't even want to go up on the fender system in the locks. The locks have wooden and rubber fenders in different locations to protect the ships. But you don't even want to touch that. And all that's working on your mind, or there in your mind, when you're maneuvering. And you're anticipating, you're looking ahead, planning every move to prevent getting into trouble or touching. The sub also has a very special paint or a very special coating on the sub, on the hull of the sub, the entire hull, to help with acoustics so that they're less noisy underwater, so they're less detectable. And you don't want to scratch that paint or that coating. A lot to it. So it's an interesting day. It's a full day's work for your senses. There's two types of those nuclear subs. There's two basic types. One would be the Ohio class. All those class of submarines are named after states. And the Ohio was the first one, came out many years ago. And the Ohio class are what they call the boomers. These are submarines that carry 24 intercontinental ballistic missiles, also with nuclear warheads. And they're in the submarine. And that also is in your mind. You're thinking about, it's not a danger, but you're thinking about the capability of this submarine, what this submarine can do, and how much the submarine costs. It costs billions of dollars to build one of these things and maintain it. And so you've got this cargo of missiles actually in their silos right behind you. And you think about the capability of that thing, that it can launch this nuclear-armed missile from 800 feet underwater or something, and it can go up and break the surface and travel thousands of miles to a target and pinpoint the location. So it's astounding. And when you travel through the sub, when you walk through it to get to the conning tower, you pass all these different things. You walk right by these silos, you know, and it comes home to you. And if the captain will ever give you a tour of their launch control room, it's very, very impressive. That really even drives it home. I had a captain give me a tour, and he described the fail-safe methods that they have in place to prevent an unwanted launch. And it's quite unique. John Clancy wrote the book, The Hunt for Red October.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the book was very accurate. The movie was all a lot of movie stuff, you know. But the other class of submarines is the Los Angeles class that are named after cities. Mm-hmm. And their specialty is not the nuclear missiles, but their specialty is hunter-killer, where they hunt other submarines. They have a whole other purpose. But they're about the same type of a vessel, and with the same, more or less the same maneuvering characteristics. You gotta be careful.
All right, well, Captain Cooper, thank you so much for coming in and agreeing to do the interview.
Sure.
And if there are no other stories,
no.
I'll go ahead and